I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share in this program. I was very much interested. Unfortunately, my plane, as some of you may know, was 2 hours late last night, so I missed hearing Father Tovar's lecture. But I was lucky enough to get a copy of it and to have a chance to read it last night, and was sort of tickled and amused with the fact that we had agreed upon a title for my talk today, which kind of plays a little bit with semantics, talking about human and woman. Actually, I'm not going to go the semantic route or the linguistic analysis route, although I did find Father Tovar's paper extremely interesting and thought-provoking, and I have several questions that I'm going to be eager to discuss with him tonight. Not negative questions at all. I thought he was doing for us something that needs doing very badly, one of which is to point out to us that whether we like it or not, we must face the fact that we are caught in linguistic difficulties in discussing this subject. And I was looking over my own notes and began to discover quite quickly how frequently I've fallen into man and mankind and he referring to God and so on. And we're just stuck with this. And I think it is, as he was pointing out, one of the areas in which perhaps we as women will have to take a good deal of leadership in trying to rethink actually the language which in a very deep sense forms our thought patterns. And I found this a very helpful insight that I want to do a lot more thinking about. Second thing that I felt he did for us, which again we all need to have done for us constantly, was to remind us that as long as we sit back in a typical feminine fashion, waiting for the men theologians to rethink the place of women in the church, we're sunk. Not because there aren't lots of men who are interested and willing, there are, but a man can only think in male thought patterns. And if we want a whole new thinking, somehow we women are going to have to get out of our feelings of inferiority, which I intend to speak about in a minute, and do it. And then, of course, the third thing touched on something which I've wanted myself sometime to try to do some thinking about and try to talk with other people about, and I guess I've just been a little scared. And that is, you remember how he, at the end, said, the important thing for us to do is to get away from the contrast of man-woman or male-female and begin thinking of this in relationship to God. And I believe he's right. You know, there have been a few daring people, men, I guess, who have said or written to the effect that we must somehow get away from our sexual connotations about God. Because obviously, the God in whom I think all of us believe cannot be thought of as male or female. We can't pick up, you know, the lovely story about the astronaut who finally got so high up that he, I guess, saw God and was asked, what is God like? And replied, she's black. But that simply is one way of opening up the issue and trying to think, to imagine somebody, a being, a spirit, which can be the kind of a God in whom we believe, and the Christian faith teaches, a God who is revealed to us in Jesus Christ, who is outside of our categories of sex, race, and so on. And this is an exceedingly difficult thing to do, and unless some of us begin to do it, we're going to be continually caught up in what I think Father Tovard was telling us to get away from in the early part of his paper, which is always seeing women as against or in contrast to man. Well, as I say, I found it a very stimulating paper, and I think we can have some fun discussing it later. Now, I'm not going to do the semantic bit on you man and woman, fun as that would be, because there are too many other things I'd like to share with you in way of perhaps rambling thoughts, but thoughts that I hope will stimulate you to thinking even better ones. First of all, I want to say I hope none of us here shudder at the word revolution. I hope this is not a word which bothers us, because I am convinced that we are living in an age of revolution and that it is a profoundly theological revolution. I am convinced that God is definitely in this revolution, is causing it, if you will, allowing it to happen, in order that in some way human life, the world, the creation, may be moved closer to God's plan for it, for reasons which only God can ever describe, we've been allowed for such a long time to go along our traditional ways with all of the injustices and all of the bad things that human beings have created in this world. And apparently now, God's patience is exhausted. And changes are coming so fast that they're terrifying all of us. And yet, being God's plan, as I'm totally convinced it is, this is good. The word revolution to me does not connote violence. Revolution is change. It's turning things around. And there are many things in our world that need to be turned around. And so I hope that as Christian women, as religious women, we look at all of this with a great deal of expectancy and joy and excitement and a longing to be right in the middle of the best of these revolutions. Since the dawn of time, in all human societies, in all human institutions, in all human organizations, a small number of elites, sometimes a large number, but more usually a small number of elites, have run things, have made the decisions, have held power over others. And the vast majority of people always have been expected to stay in their place, to do what they're told, and to obey their betters. This has just been the pattern in government, in business, in church, in education, in the family, every place. This has always been true. Now, there were, of course, some very good reasons for this. One is that through most of history, very few people have really had education, power, wealth, leisure to do this kind of thing. The vast majority of people couldn't rebel because they were either poor or illiterate or powerless or simply through most of history so overburdened with toil, with simply keeping body and soul together, that there was no energy or desire or ability to rebel against the people who were lording it over them. And since this has been true, it's interesting how folklore, common sense, even sometimes theology, picks up the things that are and rationalizes them and makes, you know, very good reasoning why this is the way it's supposed to be, why this is the way God intended the world to be. And we can look back on times when our theology has justified slavery and other things that we now feel are quite wrong. I think that there is a vestige of this kind of thinking in the situation in which all of us are today. And here I'm not thinking of the division between men and women, but I'm thinking rather of those of us who are middle-class Americans, particularly white middle-class Americans, although I think that this is true of all middle-class Americans to a certain extent, because I find that most of us in this country, I think of the church people with whom I deal 95% of the time, very few of us would think of ourselves as being rich. Many of us, we can all think of lots of people who are lots richer than we are. Some of us feel we're quite poor. And yet, we need somehow to be reminded constantly that the poorest of us middle-class Americans are among a tiny, tiny little group of the richest people who've ever lived. People who have more in a material way, who have more freedom, who have more opportunity than any people who have ever lived on this earth. And we are a very small group. 95% of the people living in the world today don't have the things that we have. And we are a greatly privileged group. Now, granted that we're wonderful and very nice and very good, it's very hard for me to believe that the God of the Bible, the God who is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the God in whom we believe, that this God really intends that a tiny little group of people should have all this and the rest of the people in the world be hungry, have no opportunity, have little medical care, have no chance to see their children grow up and so on, all the things that we take for granted. And when I think of this, then I think how important it is that we, the middle class, American Christians, not be resistant to revolution, to change, that we welcome it as an opportunity to spread throughout the whole world the kinds of things we have enjoyed. I say, I cannot imagine that God wants things the way they are now. I believe firmly, and I suspect every one of you do, that God created every human being and loves every one of us equally, regardless of race, nationality, intelligence, ability, sex, anything. That to God, each of us is precious and of equal value. We are all made in His image. And I love that phrase, you know, God made man in His own image, male and female created He them. That the male and the female are a part of the image of God, and that we can never get away from this. Now, I can't explain, even, you know, for myself, why God has allowed this injustice and inequality in the world for such a long, long time. The only way I can try to understand it is to assume that God doesn't live in our time scheme. And therefore, what seems to us like eons, thousands of years, may literally, as that beautiful hymn says, be like an evening gone to Him. And in this kind of a time scheme and His understanding of eternity, perhaps it isn't as bad as it looks. But there is no question in my mind that God has now decided to change things. He has, first of all, done this by letting human beings discover all kinds of the secrets of the universe, which He kept hidden up until now. And out of these, to develop our modern science and technology, and out of this has come such things as our rapid transportation, instantaneous communication, and an explosion of new knowledge, all kinds of new things with which most of us are quite unable to keep up. And with all of this, of course, a great extension of education. In our own country, many people being better educated, all around the world, people who have never been educated, now beginning to be. And we need to remember here, and I always think of this particularly as we're talking about the role of women, that education is a very dangerous thing. Some of you may remember a book, one of the early women's liberation books of, oh, I guess better than 20 years ago, a book called Women and Sometimes Men by Florida Scott Maxwell. She is a psychologist, and the point she makes in the beginning of the book is that all this trouble with women began when we started educating them. That you cannot take a human being and begin to teach a human being to think, to question, to, you know, be a kind of an autonomous creature, and expect that human being then to be contented with being told what to do and kept in her place. So education is a very dangerous thing, a wonderfully dangerous thing, as so many good things are, because it does give people ideas. It does encourage people to think for themselves. It encourages people to begin to question authority. And when you get the combination of increasingly widespread education and modern communication, you begin to discover that oppressed people everywhere are getting the idea that their oppressed state may not be necessary. They want change. They want revolution in the good sense of change. As I say, there's no need to assume that this means violence. Violence comes, almost without exception, when the people in power try to suppress revolution or try to suppress change. And then, sometimes, in terrible frustration, the oppressed will move to violence. Unfortunately, those in power usually have more force, and violence is not usually successful, and I think that many revolutionaries today are discovering this. But that's an aside. We see this uprising, this demand for being treated as fully human on the part of the new nations of the world, where they're saying, let us make our own decisions, let us run our own lives, we know what we need, even let us make our own mistakes, which is an important part of attaining autonomy and independence. We see it, of course, very clearly in the minority racial groups in various lands, and, of course, in some cases in the majority racial groups, as we find in South Africa. We see it in the young, because a young generation is growing up now, as we all are aware, with knowledge, information, abilities that no earlier generation has had. And they are very quickly rebelling against domination by older people who really don't understand what the modern world is all about. And now, to my great joy and delight, women are getting into the revolution. it may again be interesting here just to put in a little aside, since practically all of us, I guess all of us here, are church-related, and many of us, most of us, working very much in the church, I rejoice in the fact that the church has not been so far behind in this. My own first personal experience with discussing the place of women and the role of women and women's liberation, although that word hadn't been invented then, was back in 1950 in a World Council of Churches meeting. Now, very few people were talking at that point about the role of women. And it was the World Council of Churches, from my point of view at least, that introduced me to the fact that this was a subject worth discussing. The World Council of Churches has taken a great deal of leadership in the rethinking of the place of women in the church, and I think has been responsible for a great many good things that have happened, at least in Protestant churches around the world. So when people begin to say to you, as a good many secularists will, the church is the worst offender in the way of treating women, this may be true in some ways, but the church has also been open to some thinking, and some pretty good writing has begun to be done. And I think we are, you know, in the midst of a situation where the church perhaps can do a great deal. I'm going to try to suggest later on various specific things that I think the church is best equipped to do. One of the real problems that we face when we begin to discuss the liberation of women, the raising of the status of women, is the difficulty that so many of the people with whom you and I deal have in understanding what in the world is the issue. Because most of the people that we know are middle-class people. And as I look around this group, there, as unfortunately so often true, very few blacks here, so they tend usually to be middle-class white people. And middle-class white women of the last 100 years in this country and Western Europe have certainly had it very good in a way. We or they, however you want to put it, were shielded, pampered, encouraged to be pretty and frilly and not too smart. And if we behaved ourselves and stayed in our role, our reward would be a nice husband who would take over from our indulgent fathers and keep us in comfort, if not luxury, for the rest of our lives. Our chief roles were to be decorative, to be assets to our husbands, to be consumers, and this has grown as a very big role recently, to be mothers and homemakers. And then when, during part of the last 100 years, the drudgery was taken out of homemaking and housekeeping, this really became a very easy life, a very dangerously easy one, as any psychologist can tell you, but looked at from the outside, just about everything a person could want. And therefore, looking at that picture, the way it looks to people, it isn't hard to understand why the women's liberation movement seems absolutely incomprehensible, not only to a great many men, but to a great many women. Actually, I think women are the real problem here, because so many women have totally bought this picture and have been so contented with it and have enjoyed being the power behind the throne and have enjoyed not having to stick their necks out and get out into the front lines of social action and change, that they're going to fight, I think, harder than anyone else to prevent any changes. And so we have a real tactical problem here of how do we help women understand that this isn't all as good as it looks. I can understand very well also why my black friends, and I discuss this with many of them often, get furious at us when we compare, as Myrdal did, the liberation of women to the liberation of black people. There are a great many similarities, but of course we who are white, have to remember that the quality and the quantity of discrimination which we have suffered simply does not compare with what the blacks have had to put up with. And of course, as my black women friends tell me, they face a double jeopardy. And we have to have a very, very real concern for them and for the problems that even women's liberation poses for them, because many of them would like to be in it, many of them feel as we do about women, but they also have, in a sense, a prior loyalty to the black revolution. Well, anyway, behind the facade of this very pleasant life that people knew and that people still think about as the proper role of women, there were, as we know, some very ugly things going on. And this is what I want us to think about a little bit today, because we need to understand these deeply in our own hearts in order that we may help other people understand. And my own feeling is that the subtlest and the worst of the things that happened was the deep, deep-seated feelings of inferiority, which were simply built in, as far as I know, to practically every woman who has grown up at any time in history, including the present. When it has simply been accepted by everyone as an obvious and simple fact that women are inferior to men. And there is a great deal of evidence of this feeling of, you know, it's amazing, I'm sure you have this experience often, when one begins thinking about a subject, then you begin finding all sorts of things about it. And many of you probably read the Saturday Review and may have discovered in the October 16th issue a couple of perfectly marvelous articles. They deal with educating women. Has a delightful subtitle, No More Sugar and Spice. And a wonderful one here by Florence Howe, who is a professor at State University of New York at Old Westbury, in which she documents a good many of these things that have happened to just make women feel inferior. And the fact that this has just been completely accepted and never questioned is something that I think we all need to face up to. And then, of course, all the arrangements of society were built on this assumption. Women were kept out of leadership positions, were hindered from various kinds of education, were stopped from doing all sorts of things because, you know, women couldn't. And women, of course, swallowed this just as much as men. When this has been true, it is not too surprising, of course, that women themselves believed it. Many of you, again, are familiar, I know, with what I always think of as kind of the book that set off the women's liberation movement, which is Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex. And in there, you will remember, she points out that in very, very, very early times in human history, way back in prehistory, there was a period when people were still nomads and so on, when the brute physical strength, which is more characteristic, not always, but more characteristic of the male, was a necessity for killing wild animals for food and for cutting down the trees and clearing the forest. And therefore, at that particular period in history, the male did have a kind of an advantage of just the fact that he was stronger. And this may have been the root of much of our feelings about male superiority today. And of course, as Simone de Beauvoir points out, there are awfully few wild animals that have to be killed by hand today. But we still go back to that theory. We do ignore, of course, the fact that often in the ancient world, women did a great deal of the hard physical labor. And of course, again, in those ancient times, there were a good many matriarchal societies, which kind of disprove many of the things that we take for granted, but most of us don't know our history that well. And Simone de Beauvoir also points out that back in those dawn of time, prehistoric days, it probably, in many instances, was a very practical arrangement for the woman with the babies to stay and keep the fires going, which were essential to maintaining life, while the men did the roaming out to kill the animals. And all too soon, men began to use the fact that they got out into the larger world as a sort of an excuse for, you know, lording it over the women. After all, I've had more experience of the world than you have. You've just been stuck here by the fire. And so this is it. Now, as you all remember who've read the book, Mademoiselle de Beauvoir does go on and try to prove that from that day to this, there has been a conscious, deliberate plot on the part of men, a conspiracy to keep women in their inferior position. I'm not at all sure that that's true. I don't want to say I don't think men are that smart, but I think it has been a very unconscious kind of thing which just rose up out of experience and we take for granted and we don't question. I don't think it's a plot. And this is helpful because this means that if we begin to raise the right questions, we can get the right kind of responses and we can make changes without having to have a counterplot or something. But just watch how it's operated. Growing out of this kind of an early experience, all through history, boys have been given an education. And then the fact that they knew more, because they were the only ones that had an education, was used to prove that women's minds were inferior. You know, we educated the boys, we didn't educate the girls. Then we said, well, see, we can just show you, boys know more than girls do. Or, boys were encouraged into physical activity and sports. And again, you see this all through history. And girls were discouraged from this kind of thing. And then, the fact that men developed aggressiveness and competitiveness and physical abilities and so on was used to prove that women were inferior. And nobody looked back at the fact that women never had a chance to do this. Men were allowed all kinds of social and sexual freedom. And then this was used, and women, of course, were kept very much tied down, and this was used to prove that women were shy and dependent and timid and uninterested in things like sex. Well, we just need to begin to clarify in our own thinking and then begin to communicate in whatever nice, subtle ways we can find to do it, some of these little background facts to people. Then, of course, the next big stumbling block that I'm conscious of our running into was the development of modern psychology. And dear Dr. Freud. Now, as a psychologist, I have enormous respect for the tremendous contributions that Freud made. I mean, much that is important and essential today in our understanding of people comes out of his brilliance. But there was one area in which he was very lacking. He was a man, a male man, and he did not know or understand or ever make any effort to really understand women because he came out of a culture in which the inferiority of women was so totally accepted that even brilliant as he was, he never questioned it. Many of you, again, know the name of Karen Horney, H-O-R-N-E-Y, one of the great thinkers, I believe, among women psychologists and psychiatrists. She died just a few years ago, but has left a number of extremely important and valuable books. Karen Horney is what we sometimes speak of as a neo-Freudian. She knew Freud, I don't mean as a person, but she knew the Freudian doctrine. She was thoroughly trained in them, but began to discover fairly early in her career their shortcomings. And in one of her books, and I'm sorry that I couldn't put my hand on the book to give you the title, in the early part of it, she points out that in the early days of psychology, you see, psychology is a fairly new field, a fairly new science, really only dates back about 100 years as a self-conscious science. But in the early days, in the late 19th century, all of the old stereotypes of women about women were accepted by all psychologists. They didn't have any reason not to. They didn't know anything else, even by people as great as Freud. And as psychology developed, such fascinating ideas as the individual differences between men began to be very important. Freud did a great deal with this. Others of his followers did, helping us to differentiate, get out of the old idea that all people are alike. Individual differences among men were recognized and were studied, and a lot was discovered about this. But all women were lumped together. Women were all alike. All women were passive, hysterical, dependent, inferior, and so on. No effort whatever was made to do any of the kind of empirical study of women that began to be done about men. And the first break came as, in the early years of this century, psychology began to be a more objective science, and there began to be more empirical studies. I personally think that probably the first big breakthrough came with the development of intelligence testing in France, Binet and Simon and their tests. And these were well-constructed tests, were developed actually probably in the first place, were used almost entirely with men because, you know, women didn't have intelligence. But then they began using them in schools. And the shock that ran through the whole world when they began to discover that there were no sex differences, that women, young girls and older women, as they took these pretty solid intelligence tests, were just as bright as men. Nobody had ever thought of such a thing before. And they began to discover that the differences between women were as large as the differences between men, and that there were often men and women who were much more alike in intelligence than all women were or all men were. This was a very traumatic point, of which I think not enough has been made. And I would, you know, in one of my other incarnations, I'd like to really go into this and write a book about it. But we began then to discover this. And then a very few people began to say, why is it, if this is true in childhood and in young adulthood, that there isn't any major difference in intelligence, what is it that makes women and men so different? And therefore, there began to be the studies, which are just beginning now, really, not anything like complete, of the role of early childhood training in influencing behavior. Earlier, we just assumed that all these things were born into you. Women were born wanting to mother people, and men were born wanting to be aggressive and go out and fight. But we're now increasingly realizing how much of this is part of our training. And, of course, finally, as Karen Horneye points out, when we began to have some women psychologists and women psychiatrists who could understand their own feelings and their own reactions and could relate to other women, then the dam really began to break, and we began to discover more and more of the both likenesses and the real differences, as over against the old stereotype differences between men and women. Today, of course, as a result of this, we know, and this is indisputable, we know that women are every bit as bright and capable as men. Now, this doesn't mean that every woman is as bright as every man, because there are enormous differences. But the differences are not sex-based. And we just, it sounds so silly to say this, because we all know it, and yet, even though we know it, many of us still act as though it weren't so. You find yourself, I find myself, even though I know this so well, often in a group of men, you know, being a little bit scared to speak up. And I realize that probably this is just this long years of training that, you know, men are smarter. And I must listen to them. Now, sometimes it isn't that. Sometimes it's just plain strategy. But but it is urgent. It's absolutely urgent that we who are women begin to understand and believe and accept this and see to it that it begins to be passed on to the next generation. Because here is where one of the real problems lies, in the indoctrination, the inculcation into female children before they're a year old, of the fact that they are inferior. I don't want to take time to read you a lot out of this Florence Howe article, but I'd like to just read enough of it to get your, you know, get your curiosity whetted, so you'll go and hunt up a copy of it. She says, children learn about sex roles very early in their lives, probably before they are 18 months old, certainly long before they enter school. They learn these roles through relatively simple patterns that most of us take for granted. We throw boy babies up in the air and roughhouse with them. We coo over girl babies and handle them delicately. We choose sex-related colors and toys for our children from their earliest days. We encourage the energy and physical activity of our sons, just as we expect girls to be quieter and more docile. We love both our sons and daughters with equal fervor. We protest, we protest that we love them both with equal fervor, and yet we are always disappointed if there is no male child to carry on the family name. I mean, this kind of thing, which so early gets built in. And then her article goes on, since this is a speech she gave to school administrators, to give just, you know, really horrible, horrifying stories of the way in which the best of our schools today are, right from the kindergarten up, doing this. In kindergarten, the little girls are expected to play with little girls' toys, and the little boys are expected to play with little boys' toys. And I'm sure many of you have read some of the studies that have been made just in the last year or two about children's books, the way in which children's books always picture boys as active, successful, exciting, doing things, and, as she points out in here, usually present girls as passive and quiet and having problems. So, we need to look at that. It's just very interesting to see what happens. Well, anyway, this is where we are at the moment. And we need to remember that women are equal and are just as bright, just as capable as men. It's very important, as I say, for us to know this and to try in every way we can both to get it into our own subconscious minds and to share it with other women, and particularly with young women and girls. Because a real feeling of being inferior is one of the most inhibiting things in the world. It restricts a person's ambition, a person's ability to do things. It's a very restricting thing. Any psychologist, any psychiatrist, I think, will tell you that your entire lifestyle will be inhibited and restricted if you have even deeply hidden a feeling of being inferior to other people, or particularly to a whole group of people. I have a very bad habit of remembering silly things at a particular point, and this makes me think of a silly thing, which doesn't fit the subject at all, except just talking about inferiority. A number of years ago, there was a delightful cartoon in some magazine which showed, it was a woman, could have been a man though, in a psychiatrist's office. And the psychiatrist, obviously at the end of his rope, saying, "Madam, you don't have an inferiority complex. You are inferior." As I said, this could well have been a man, but I suppose if one is really inferior, and all of us are to some people in some areas, this is all right. That's not a problem. The problem is the deep inferiority complex, the deep feeling of inferiority, which may have no basis in fact. Now, seeing this does not mean, I believe, that men and women are exactly alike. I think this has been one of the mistakes of some of the early feminists. I don't sense it today very much, but it was for a while. Men and women are not exactly alike. And I suppose the second, after we get over, if we can just really begin to believe that women are in every way equal in ability and so on to men, then the second thing I believe that we all need to somehow pound into our subconscious, and it's very hard to do, is that it is perfectly possible to be different without inequality. And this is something, you know, that human beings cannot seem to grasp. We have just apparently built into us a sort of a feeling that if things are different, one must be above the other. I don't know why we think that everything has to go this way. And it is very important for us to think about this, talk about it, find other illustrations out of various other areas of life where great difference can exist without any implication of inequality. Certainly we who are white desperately need this as we deal with the non-white majority of people in the world, because we have lived for so long with some kind of a totally hidden assumption that whiteness is superior. And it isn't. We know it isn't intellectually. We've got to somehow get to the deep subconscious realization of this. And in the same way, we as women need to be able to cheerfully, and I would say joyously, because actually I think some of the things we've got are very desirable, joyfully admit that we're not alike, men and women. We are different in a great many ways. And I love the French idea. I mean, vive la différence, because this is enriching. This is what I'm sure God means it to be. But difference does not imply inequality. We simply do not know today. We absolutely do not know what traits are born in us. What are actually inborn genetic sexual differences? There is every day, doctors and psychologists and others are discovering new evidence that things we always assumed were true may not be. We're being pushed back farther and farther to find that things are socially conditioned, that we're educated into many things that we used to think were born, inborn traits. Now, I'm sure that there probably are some, but as was indicated in that little bit I read to you from Florence Howe, now as we are able to experiment with younger and younger children, we're discovering that many things that we always assumed were inborn traits really have been trained into us from our cradles. And we are realizing, as she says, that we treat infants differently. And as children grow up, they are very quickly conditioned to behaving according to masculine and feminine stereotypes. We encourage aggressive behavior by little boys. You know, we just think it's great. You see a little two-year-old boy out beating up somebody, and we may scold him for hitting another child, but down inside we say, he's a good little, real little man. He can take care of himself. So a little girl does this, what happens? She gets spanked, doesn't she? Good and hard. Recent studies, of course, of children's books and so on show glaring evidence of the stereotype. So the number three thing, we try to get over our basic inferiority feeling. We try to really come to understand that difference does not mean inequality. And then I think the third big job we've got to do is to get out on a real expedition against stereotyping. Because this is a, again, a great human characteristic. I can understand it in a way, and I think you can too, because the world is terribly complex. There are, you know, so many people with whom we must relate and so on and so on. It's awfully hard to really be willing to take every individual with whom you must relate as an individual. I guess just in order to cope with the size of the problem, most of us have to set up some pigeonholes that we can stick people in, you know, so that it makes it a little more possible. And this may be essential, but let's know what we're doing. Let's know what we're doing. And be very careful about our stereotyping. Because this, I think, is what is damaging, not just women. And here I move into what is one of my strong theories about the women's liberation movement, that basically, in the long run, it's going to be men's liberation. Because I think I believe now that, as a matter of actual fact, men are more damaged by the kind of stereotyping that is applied to them than women are. And that we women, if we can be courageous and brave and strong and carry through this women's liberation, destroy stereotyping, not only will we find a liberation and a much more fruitful life, but men will also. And I find increasing numbers of men who are recognizing this and who are glad to join with us. Many men, for example, are not, as far as we can discover, by nature, aggressive, competitive, and rough. There are lots of men who are quiet and rather gentle and so on, and yet what we have done, you see, in our stereotyping is to label those as feminine qualities and to raise our eyebrows when we see a man who exhibits those. And I have a very strong hunch, and I would love, again, you know, another incarnation sometime, to do some research on this. I wonder if a great deal of the homosexuality that is coming so much to the fore today is not based largely on this kind of stereotyping, that a man, for example, who happens not to fit the stereotype of the aggressive, competitive man, instead of being allowed to develop a kind of maleness which is congenial to him, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be many different patterns of masculinity, instead of being allowed to do that in our society, he just subconsciously rejects all maleness. And that this may be the psychological mechanism that is behind a good deal of homosexuality. And one little evidence of this, as you know, there is presumably, as far as we know, considerably less homosexuality among women than among men. And I think this is perhaps because girls are not pushed quite as hard into impossible stereotypes as men are. And therefore, it is a much easier for a woman to adjust depending on what her own particular desires are. But I may be wrong on that. This is something that needs a lot of experimentation, but it's a little hint of what we may be doing to men. Because women, as I say, the role images for girls are not as distinct as they are for men. Women don't perhaps have the same push to become homosexual, but what I think a lot of women do when they don't find their roles comfortable and congenial is to move into a kind of what I would call a regressive infantilism. They don't know what to do with themselves, and so they just are sort of unwilling to grow up. Don't you know a lot of women like this, who really, in a sense, never grown up? All these little girls, and you know, they're so cute, and we all kind of pet them and love them, and men find them irresistible. But they just never want to become autonomous, independent human beings. And I think this, again, is perhaps a rejection of a role that is not comfortable. We all know this kind of woman. She always has to have someone, preferably a male someone, on whom to lean. And I find this woman very difficult to cope with because she fits so many of the stereotypes of the feminine woman. I think our ideas of what makes a feminine woman need a lot of rethinking. She always needs somebody to lean on. She wants to depend on someone, usually a male, for making decisions. And above all, she expects this someone to give meaning to her life. She's not willing to have a life of her own. And so she becomes, you see, the kind who, you've heard them, you've met them. People say, isn't she marvelous? She just doesn't live for anything except her husband or her family. She has no, you know, she's just so beautiful, just such a devoted person. Well, I think this may be one of the most dangerous kind of characters that's loose in our society today. Because While some men are at times pleased and flattered by this sort of adoration, there's a good deal of evidence that it frequently becomes an intolerable burden. I don't know that any human being has a right to place upon another human being the burden of giving meaning to one's existence. That we all have the responsibility of working this out ourselves with our Creator and becoming autonomous individuals. And our society, our way of thinking, and all kinds of things have, I think, forced this sort, or at least made possible, this sort of living on the part of women. And these are the women who are usually played up in the mass media and all kinds of things like that as the ideal of femininity. And yet I think this may be extremely dangerous. They regress to an almost non-human behavior when they are widowed, this kind of woman. Don't all of you know widows who just totally go to pieces when the center of their life is gone? And I think one of the even more dangerous things is that such women, if they find that their husbands, for example, do not really provide the kind of support and focus that they need, then take it out in clinging to and dominating their children. And our society, particularly our American society, is just full of this kind of dominating woman. She's so gentle and she's so sweet, and nobody believes it, but she's probably the most aggressive person in the society in a very dangerous way. All of us, I know, have seen the tragic consequences of this kind of depending upon other people to give meaning to your life. Now, what do we need today to help the female half of our world achieve real humanness? First, of course, is an understanding of the fact that it is not necessary in any relationship for one person to dominate the other. And this is something that I think modern psychology, all kinds of modern experimentation is showing us, that you do not have to have in any relationship, whether it's a work relationship, a love relationship, a companionship relationship, it isn't the case that one has to be on top. And this, again, is part of our folklore. I've found, as I've been talking over the last 20 years or so about, you know, the liberation of women, so often a person will, in response, say, oh, so you want women to run the world, do you? No, I don't want women to run the world. Yeah, but neither do I want men to run the world. And there is no reason on God's green earth why we can't learn how to cooperate, why we can't work together. I think this is what God made us for, what he intended us to do, and it's perfectly possible in man-woman relationships, as in any other relationship, to have an open, free, collaborative kind of a relationship. Men in our society have so often, there are a lot of things against this. One of them is, of course, that men in our society have been so dominated in their childhood by dominating mothers and dominating women school teachers, that unfortunately a great many adult men today have a deep, deep fear of women. And this is something we're going to have to help overcome. And at the same time, girls and women suffer from their feelings of inferiority and that kind of fear. And it's going to take some doing to undo these two fears and get us to the point where we are able to relate. But even recognizing that we each have fears will help. Now, in the last two or three minutes, I should have stopped by now, let me just hit on a few of the areas where I think things can be done, because most of us are in some or all of these areas. There's a tremendous need for a new kind of education in the home. And those of us who have opportunities through the church, for example, dealing with young people as they marry and as they establish their families, with young parents and so on, may have opportunities to help parents get away from the kind of sex stereotyping that we have inherited in our home. Get away from making differentiations in babies and small children between the things that boys and girls do. Let them grow up together. There have begun to be some very interesting experiments done with this, showing that children who are just, you know, little girls that are allowed to play with trucks and automobiles and put things together and so on, develop a real delight in this kind of skill and enjoy it and become feel less inferior than girls who are always just kept with dolls and sewing kits. So we need to look at this in the home. I'm very much interested in what may happen to this whole area as we move in our society, as we are doing today, toward earlier and earlier schooling for children. And I think there may be a great deal of value in this, because it would be much easier In the control situation of a nursery school, if we begin to get two-year-olds, for example, and if the teachers have any intelligence, it'll be much easier to begin to break some of these patterns there than will be to try to do it in all the millions of homes in this country. So if you are working in early childhood education, keep this always in mind as one of the things that will open up to us. And early childhood education often gives children a good chance to mingle more freely with the other sex. And this is good right from the beginning. And again, thinking of the family, we ought to look with considerable interest and maybe even favor on some of the experiments that are being made in trying to get the American family out of its isolation. You see, we have an isolation of the nuclear family that has really never existed in any other society. And this is very hard on children because it gives them so few role images. And some of the experiments that are being done with communal family living and so on might have some very good things to say, so let's at least look at them. Then, of course, in the schools, and lots of us here are related to schools in one way or another, we must do everything the school can do to break stereotypes. Let girls take manual training, and let boys take cooking, if they want to. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Stop assuming that girls are not good at math and science. There have been some very good studies made indicating what the expectations of teachers do to children, and it's been proved that teachers tend to assume that girls will hate math and like literature. And if the teacher has this unconscious assumption, it'll happen. And yet, again, there's enough evidence to show that mathematics particularly is one of the things that is exceedingly congenial to women. And there are some extremely good women mathematicians given a half a chance when they're little. One of the things that we've got to think through in school, and this is too big a subject to go into now, is the whole problem of coeducation during adolescence. Not because I'm afraid of boys and girls getting together at that period. I think they must, and it's good. But how can we get over the problem that in this period, girls fall into the trap of not wanting boys to know how smart they are? The old stereotype, you see, if you're too smart, the boys won't like you. We're going to have to break that one someplace. Otherwise, we find adolescent girls afraid to do their best in a coeducational situation. Now, I don't think the answer is to abolish coeducation. The answer is to get back there and see what we can do about those attitudes. And then, of course, what we need is, as we move out of the school, to use all of our skills, all of us and all of our connections, to help men and women, boys and girls and men and women, understand the changing lifestyles of today. Understand, for example, the need for continuing education for everybody. We're no longer going to be able to educate people in 12 or 16 years. We know that, but people... Our schools still operate as though that was it, as though you're going to get your education there. We need to open this field. We need to open up the fact that the whole job situation is going to change. We no longer pick a vocation and stick to it for life. Men as well as women are mobile. And, of course, we need particularly to help women understand the new life patterns of women and not assume that, as still I would say the vast majority of adolescent girls, if you ask them what their real dream of the future is, it is to get married and have a family and live happily ever after. And if you try to explain to them that they will not live that way, that they will have to at some time or want at some time in their lives to work, to have a career, and they ought to be training for it, they just bat their big blue eyes at you and say, oh, I don't really want to do that. We've got to get to work on helping them to understand the realities of life. Not because these are harsh realities, because they're beautiful realities. And, of course, I think we need to do a lot of thinking, and here I think the church has a great role. The church has had more influence than probably it realizes in the establishment of our patterns of family life or in blessing them. And therefore, the church could very well be the place where we could begin to think about new patterns of family life, where we no longer assume that the woman is the decoration and does the little things that still have to be done in the home, and the man has to carry all the burden of financial responsibility and so on. We need to take that burden off the men. We need to encourage people to be cooperative about this. We need to restore fathers to their children and children to their fathers. There's a great deal that must be done, much more real sharing in earning, homemaking, citizen participation in the community. And I think that in study groups and discussion groups and all kinds of places within the church, this kind of thing could be discussed. I don't know where else it can be discussed because there just aren't those opportunities. And another thing that I would like us to really take seriously, we have a great opportunity as church-related women to make singleness both attractive and legitimate. Because I don't know, I think this may be a plot on the part of men, I'm not quite certain, but somehow to assume that the ideal, the only real life, is marriage, is, I think, just a contradiction of all that I believe about what God intended for his children. Marriage is a very fine thing. I'm thoroughly in favor of it. It's a great institution, but it isn't essential. One can have a full, rich, beautiful life, even if we can begin to break some of our silly conventions, even delightful relationships with the opposite sex, which need not be physically sexual, although even that, of course, is certainly up for grabs in our present society. But we need desperately to try to stop all of us as older women, the women with whom we deal, who are perhaps mothers of girls today, stop the pressure on girls to marry. I mean, stop the assumption that this is the only mark of success. I think this is a kind of a thing that women have given into that is very, very bad. And sometimes I think that it's primarily those of us who perhaps are married or have been married who can fight this battle the best. And we need to do it. And we need to be fighting for the legitimacy and actually the attractiveness of a woman having such a great zeal for the career, the job, the vocation that she's chosen, that she will very definitely, as of course many women have done, choose not to marry, or if she marries, to choose to marry within some kind of a framework which will permit her to continue with her work. But we need to make normal relationships of friendship and work and so on between men and women much more acceptable than they are. Somehow, the overemphasis on sex, physical sex in our world, is, I think, something that works very much against women. And we need to somehow try to get away from it. It's understandable, I guess, if we think of the physiological makeup of men and women. Sex and sexuality is somehow so much more ever-present, I believe, physiologically in a man's makeup. But we women need to help them get away from that. And to understand sexuality, that is, our being male or female, as such a wonderful, enriching thing, and not as something which is limited strictly to a physical relationship. This is too big. Again, this is a subject for another whole talk, but it's something we all need to think about. And I believe completely that the church could be the most important place for all of this kind of rethinking to happen. But it's not going to do so until women are much more involved in all levels of the church than they are now. They need to share with men. And this, I don't know, this may mean women in the ministry, women, ordained women. Many of you here are ordained women, and that may be the group. Personally, I just assume at this point work more on restoring ministry to its proper role. You see, when we use the word ministry to mean the ordained person, we really are talking about not ministry, but we're talking about the location of power in the church structure. It's the ordained who have the power in the church structure. And therefore, I think one of the things we women could begin to do is to attack that issue. Where is the power, really? If it is in the ordained, then we've got to fight for the ordination of women. If we could change the picture so that the ordained does not necessarily mean the power structure, then men or women, lay or ordained, could share equally in rebuilding the image of the people of God, the church, as a real pattern for human relationships. Thanks.